The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. There seems to be a preconception that Buddhism teaches that if you practice the teachings well and successfully, that suffering is going to go away. This is, of course, not the Buddhist teaching, but it seems to be a preconception that many form, either before practicing Buddhism and sometimes after as well. Become a Buddhist and you won't suffer. Train hard and you won't suffer. Meditate deeply and you won't suffer. It's impressive to me how deep our ignorance of our true condition can be. And it's even more impressive that we can, even when we know better, suffer from the idea or convince ourselves, either subtly or not so subtly, that suffering is somehow going to go away. It isn't. The Buddha taught that, well, let's put it this way, he did not teach that there was escape from suffering. He did not preach an escape. Instead, he taught people how to free themselves from suffering through the practice of his teaching, which includes four very basic and important things with regard to suffering. The first is to learn to recognize it as it is, as it arises, and for what it is. The second, to understand its cause and its creation. The third, to awaken to accepting of and embracing the cessation of suffering, the possibility that suffering can cease. And the full acceptance and wholehearted practice of training in order that these other three things may be proven true, embraced, and accomplished through the fourth thing. This is really just a restating of the Noble Eightfold Path. I'm sorry, the Four Noble Truths. Of the Four Noble Truths. Suffering exists, there is a cause, there is a cessation. There is a Noble Eightfold Path or a way for the cessation to come about. Nowhere in there does it say that suffering, you will escape from it. What it teaches is liberation, freedom from suffering. Not through the escape from suffering, but by going through it. By experiencing it. This is also a reminder and a reiteration of what Dogen talks about when he says the most important question for all Buddhists is how to understand birth and death completely. Now, in exploring Samantabhadra's fifth vow, to rejoice at the attainment of merit by others, I have been talking about, and possibly may even have introduced some of you to the four immeasurables, or the practice of the four immeasurables: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. If I were going to do this again, and if I were going to explain the fifth vow of Samantabhadra again, I might well do it differently. I might not mention the four immeasurables at all, except indirectly. The reason for this is that the teachings are so kaleidoscopic that you can apply different teachings or different sets of teachings to the same circumstance. It all depends on the people, the teacher, the situation, all these different factors. You look at it one way, and you can look at it another way, and you can look at it another way beyond that, and another way in addition to that. You can look at the ways and means to rejoice at the attainment of others in many different ways, and with many different aspects of the Buddha's teachings. For one particular person, at one particular time, the way that we look now, this is the way we are looking at it. For another person, for another time, we may look at it differently. But it will still be through the practice of the Four Noble Truths, and we will still be attempting to understand and to practice rejoicing at the attainment of merit by others. If you are practicing Buddhism, you are always addressing or putting your attention on the same thing, which is dealing with suffering. And you are doing it in the same way, i.e., training. In some form or other, you're going to be working on suffering. And certainly the only way in Buddhism to work with suffering that is effective is to learn how to train, to practice, to meditate, to put the teachings into practice. Looking at it in a slightly different way, or in a more practical way, there are many different ways to build a bookcase. There are a number of things about that bookcase, in order for it to be a bookcase, that one is going to have to keep in mind when one is building it. It's got to hold books, for one. But the way in which it holds books, and how it's supported, or if it's freestanding, or if it's made with brackets, or if the shelves are a certain length, all these different details, these are all different. And this is the way, or this is one of the ways, of the approach of the four immeasurables. It is the one way, it is one way that I at the moment am using to approach this vow of Samantabhadra Bodhisattvas. It's not the only way, but it is a way that I think is particularly good. Now, we're going to talk a little bit today about continuing the practice of this rejoicing at the attainment of merit by others by introducing you to another one of the four immeasurables, mudita. Mudita is sometimes called gladness, sometimes called appreciative joy, and sometimes called sympathetic joy. It's not just being glad. It's not just being sympathetic or empathetic. Mudita, when it is practiced, directly works on or converts the poisons of jealousy and also inadequacy. By jealousy, I mean jealousy, obviously, but also resentment, bitterness, envy, and sour grapes, too. I'm not talking about the obvious type of jealousy, which is the distrust of the fidelity of a spouse or a lover. However, it can still help with that. Jealousy is the consuming fear, suspicion, or belief that one is or might be being displaced in someone's affections, attentions, or success. Jealousy also expresses resentment or envy of another person, of his or her possible or actual success, advantage, or superiority. That's what our dictionaries will tell us about jealousy. One of the common expressions of jealousy is rivalry, competition, and when you leave it unchecked as a passion, it leads to the destruction of other people, either in thought, in word, or in deed. In our culture, we do not have a strong sense of sympathetic joy, I think, probably because it tends to undermine one's sense of self. It's not really good for the self. Practicing sympathetic joy does not necessarily go along with the deepest desires of one's own personality. It should, but it doesn't. We can sometimes tend not to rejoice or celebrate at the successes of others, but instead make pronouncements about them and be quick to comment or act out of cynicism or negativity. There's this wonderful scene in a British movie, I believe it's in the Kind Hearts and Coronets, where someone asks another man, there are two bankers or people in high finance or politics, is so-and-so sound? And the other says, he's not unsound. And that's all that's said. That person's career is gone. Right like that. Practicing mudita means rejoicing when someone does something good and right, and feeling sorry for someone when they do something wrong. It is more than positive thinking, more than giving someone strokes, I think is one of the terms that's used. It is more than saying good for you, but it's literally letting go of oneself and becoming happy because others are happy and successful. In terms of eradicating jealousy, and by eradication I would mean more in Buddhism, it's conversion, because you don't get rid of anything. You convert it. You turn it into something that is good and useful and helpful to yourself and others. Mudita is most applicable under these circumstances. When one cannot bear to see or hear about the successes of others, when one rejoices over the failure of another but is distressed by their success, when, instead of praising and congratulating someone on their achievement and success, one tries to discredit, ruin, condemn, or vilify them. This is pretty strong stuff. And I don't think anyone would really want to recognize or admit to the fact that they are a jealous, resentful, envious, or bitter person. I know I wouldn't. But I'm afraid that after many, many years of looking at my own mind and what it does, I am deeply disturbed and sobered by it. Someone who practices mudita will not try to hinder or adversely affect the progress and welfare of another. In fact, it may lend itself to actually aiding in that, to making a person a success. It really points out our attachments to preferences, to those things and people we like and those we dislike, the pettiness that we can stoop to, and our tendency towards aversion, just avoiding those things we don't like. It's easy to rejoice over the success of someone who we love and cherish. It's harder to do it with somebody that we don't like, or we don't think much of. Or we, you know, hear them and the first thing we think is, oh, him, or oh, her. When someone acts to obstruct, discredit, ruin, or harm an adversary, this is the opposite of mudita. And I find it really helpful to think of mudita and the damage that it can do when you think in terms of the first precept, killing Buddha, or killing. Most jealousies, bitternesses, resentments are not going to lead to someone's actually killing another person. But there are a lot of injuries and killing that is done with this as a motive. It's very disturbing. Although damaging another's joy, success, and accomplishments is hardly in the same class as killing the person, it can still happen. Damaging the joy of other people. Reverend Master used to talk a lot about the tarnish wand, that you would be working hard on something, you know, work for a long time to create or do. You had managed to achieve it, and someone comes along with their tarnish wand, sort of like the Wicked Witch of the West, and just sort of puts a tarnish on the joy of it. We got to watch out for that. Interestingly enough, the practice of mudita begins with meditation practice and really just watching what your own mind is doing. I remember back when I was in, fifth or sixth grade, my brother did confirmation in the Catholic Church. And my brother was 4 years older than I was, tall, handsome, could do anything. You know, I was this little fat kid who smiled a lot, you know. And about the biggest accomplishment I had was I could ride my bike, you know. I rode it a lot, though. And I found myself very jealous of him. And, you know, here were all these people making all this fuss, and it was confirmation and everything like that. And, I was so jealous, so resentful, so bitter about the whole thing. I remember that during the meal, we went out with friends. I behaved so abominably that I was sent out to the car. You know, you'd sit out in the car while everybody else is eating. You know. And yet, if you suffer from inadequacy, if you think that something within you is missing and that others have it, and they're getting all the, you know, all the attention, and they've got all this stuff, and you've got nothing. There you have it. Practicing meditation, paying attention to your own mind, and just watching when it comes up, watching for the seeds of jealousy, of resentment, of bitterness. And when you see them, which you will, just don't water them. Just say, ah, there it is. And let it go. You can also plant seeds as well by remembering mudita, sympathetic joy, rejoicing in the merits of others. It disturbs me a lot how, as I get older and older, and I noticed this before when I was younger, but I seem to notice it every much more so now, how very cynical and bitter people become as they age. Not everyone, but how cynical and bitter they can become. It's easy when you have been disappointed a lot. But something like mudita can really help to raise a person's view and vision, not only of themselves, but also of others. Stillness and mindfulness, letting go as it arises, making that very moment the opportunity to practice it. And if you can't practice it, to want to practice it. It doesn't mean that you're, you know, a failure if at the first arising you don't do cartwheels because you've heard that the person you hate the most has now become your boss. You know. I apologize for the extreme language. I don't think it's necessary, but I think you get the idea. You got to start where you are. Start somewhere, in a place that's realistic. And say, well, you know, I'm happy for so-and-so, at least officially. I may not feel this as a burning passion at the moment, but I can recognize that here's an opportunity for me to practice appreciative joy and be happy for the person. There is a line in the dedication of loving kindness which says, may they not lose whatever they have gained. May a person never lose what they have gained. Appreciative joy. Now, I don't know if you think that in what we've been talking about over the past number of weeks in terms of loving kindness and compassion, whether for you these are difficult things to practice. According to the commentaries that are written about loving kindness and compassion, they're supposed to be. Mudita is something that's hard to practice. That's what the commentarists say. It requires a lot of effort and a lot of willpower. Why that is, I don't know. But it just seems to be the case, which leads me to believe that we are all in deep need of practicing appreciative joy, even though we may be relatively happy people. One writer, although he put it in the negative, I'm putting it in the positive, portrayed the world sort of at the, he portrayed the world at the mercy of jealousy. I'm going to portray it to you at what it would be like if everyone practiced mudita, appreciative joy. Nations would rejoice over the prosperity of other nations. One race would rejoice in the growing prosperity of another race. One religious sect would rejoice that another sect was having so much success and influence with so many people. Institutions and businesses would seek the prosperity of other institutions and businesses, as well as aid in their advancement so that there would be enough opportunity for everyone's success. Families and neighbors would not feud, hold grudges, or try to hurt one another. People would have much less reservation in aiding those around them because they would be contributing to the good of everyone out of joy, out of the sense of completeness. It converts jealousy, envy, resentment, and dislike. And interestingly enough, as a byproduct, it eliminates boredom and restlessness. I think the reason for that is because it engenders in a person such a sense of contentment and joy that one does not become bored or restless. When you think about the meaning of, especially I think of mudita, but the other of the three of the other three of the four immeasurables, and you were to apply these teachings to society, you would see that the Buddha was actually the greatest social revolutionary that ever lived. But he just didn't try to go around and put it in people's faces. He just said, it's up to you. You put the teachings into practice. Prove it true for yourself. Or as somebody here in their first Dharma talk quoted very aptly, he would invoke the slogan of Nike and just say, just do it. There is a very interesting story in the tales of the early disciples of the Buddha about two monks who had a great loving friendship for each other. There were two famous monks. One was the Venerable Shariputra, and the other was the Venerable Ananda. According to one of the commentaries, Shariputra felt deep love and affection for Ananda based on gratitude for Ananda's being willing to become the attendant of the Buddha. And Shariputra is thinking, he is attending on the master, a duty which should have been performed by me. Not that he's doing the job and I should be doing it, but that he's doing something. I feel a great obligation to be doing this as well, and he is doing it. How wonderful, how much, you know, joy and appreciation I have for his doing it. Ananda's affection was due to the fact that Shariputra had been declared by the Buddha as his foremost disciple. When Ananda gave novice ordination to young people, he used to take them to Shariputra to obtain higher ordination under him. Shariputra did the same in regard to Ananda, and in that way they had 500 pupils in common, each sort of praising the other and saying, oh yes, so-and-so is a very fine teacher, please learn from him. You can only do better. Whenever Ananda received choice robes or other requisites, he would offer them to Shariputra. And in the same way, Shariputra passed on to Ananda any special offerings that were made to him. Once Ananda received from a certain Brahmin a very valuable robe, and with the Buddha's permission, he kept it for 10 days, awaiting Shariputra's return. The sub-commentary says that later teachers commented on this. There may be those who say we can well understand that Ananda, who has not yet attained to arhantship, felt such affection. But how is it in the case of Shariputra, who is a canker-free arhant? Some believe that when you became an arhant, you would no longer feel any kind of affection towards another person. To this we answer, Shariputra's affection was not one of attachment, but a love for Ananda's virtues. The Buddha once asked Ananda, do you too approve of Shariputra? And Ananda replied, who, Lord, would not approve of Shariputra, unless he were childish, corrupt, stupid, or of perverted mind? Shariputra is wise, of great wisdom, of broad, bright, quick, keen, and penetrative wisdom. Shariputra is of few wants and contented, inclined to seclusion, not fond of company, meaning he was diligent as a recluse, energetic, eloquent, willing to listen, an exhorter who censures what is evil. In the Theragata, we find Ananda describing his feeling at the time of Shariputra's death. When the noble friend Shariputra had gone, he declares, the world was plunged in darkness for me. But he adds that after the companion had left him behind, and the Buddha had also passed away, there was no other friend like mindfulness. Shariputra was a true friend in the fullest sense of the word. He well understood how to bring out the best in others, and in doing so did not hesitate sometimes to speak straightforwardly and critically, like the ideal friend described by the Buddha, who points out his friend's faults. This is an important aspect in Buddhism, that monks are supposed to develop constructive criticism, to point out each other's faults, so that one can simply say, do you realize that, you know, upon this day and in this particular day, you came this close to ripping my lips off? This is not good. You're actually supposed to be able to talk to each other like this, to not take offense, and then to be able to say, yes, I recognize that I almost tore the Venerable One's lips off, and I apologize and will not do it in the future. And be able to maintain good feeling while this is going on. I'm not saying we always succeed at that, but we do try to practice it. It was through such honest criticism that he helped the Venerable Aniruddha in his final breakthrough to arhantship. Once the Venerable Aniruddha went to see the Venerable Shariputra. When they had exchanged courteous greetings, he sat down and said to the Venerable Shariputra, friend Shariputra, with a divine eye that is purified, transcending human sight, I can see the thousandfold world system. Firm is my energy, unremitting. My mindfulness is alert and unconfused. My body is tranquil and unperturbed. My mind is concentrated and one-pointed. And yet, my mind is not freed from the cankers, not freed from clinging. Friend Anuruddha, said the Venerable Shariputra, that you think thus of your divine eye, this is conceit. That you think thus of your firm energy, your alert mindfulness, your unperturbed body, and your concentrated mind, this is conceit and restlessness. That you think of your mind not being freed from the cankers, this is worrying. It would be good indeed if you abandon these three states of mind, and paying no attention to them, direct your mind to nirvana. In other words, the Venerable Anuruddha came in, all puffed up, and Shariputra took his little pin and went, boop. And the Venerable Anuruddha, instead of saying, oh, you've destroyed my self-image, instead thanked him and became an arhat because he taught him what was true. There is a teaching of the Buddha saying that a true friend is someone who says what is hard to say and does what is hard to do for another. To practice it, begin with meditation and mindfulness. Just look at your own mind. When you see the tarnish wand come out, or, you know, someone says something and you're about to respond with some kind of cynicism or negativity, the seeds of envy, bitterness, resentment, jealousy. Let them sit there on the hot pavement. They won't germinate there. Don't toss any water on them. Don't put them in soil. Just let them be. And also, if as and when necessary, plant seeds. Appreciative joy. Rejoicing in the merits of others. You can see how loving kindness, compassion, become sympathetic joy. And the vow of Samantabhadra, the fifth, is to rejoice at the attainment of merit by others. Reverend Master, her translation of this was without jealousy, greed, or snide remarks, too. This is the teaching of mudita, sympathetic joy, which I seem to have explained somewhat badly today. Nevertheless, I think you get the idea. Thank you, friends.